Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on inflation when we come back. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, it was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai. You and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Now, George Bush said that what Americans want is jobs, jobs, jobs. But that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognize that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured, nor has it ever been measured, in employment or jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in business. The money is in private business. The money is in sales, not in public business or jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I cash in on our inheritance and learn how to collect those benefits from the old covenant contract, and to collect those benefits in real property, like gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for information on my CD Home School for Adults? So it's our business school. And while you're at it, why don't you order the free General Law CD package at the same time? Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Then click on to the email machine. Send an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, if there's one thing that I've observed in my lifetime, is that human beings cannot learn from their mistakes. And if they can, I haven't observed that. Now, I can see a dog. He can learn from his mistakes. He makes a mess on the floor. You beat him up, and he'll quit doing that. You rub his nose in it, and he'll stop. A dog can learn from his mistakes. Human beings do not have that proclivity. In fact, a human being will always take the course of least resistance. Now, there are examples of some exceptions to that rule. I'm aware of that. But the general rule is, you take 100 people out here, and you subject those 100 people to an event. And let's suppose that that event is very distasteful. I mean, it is terrible. It is an awful event, like Hurricane Katrina in Biloxi, Mississippi. Now, there was a hurricane came in there about 1969 called Camille. You remember that? Some of you old-timers maybe remember Camille. Now, before Camille, there were hurricanes that came in there before Camille in 1969. It's just that it's so far back, we haven't got any records. We can't remember that. We couldn't learn from Hurricane Camille, so we rebuilt along that shoreline again, which was just destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. Now, we're not going to learn from Hurricane Katrina. We are going to rebuild again. And at some indefinite time in the future, there's going to be another hurricane come in there and destroy it all, just like it did this time, which is the point that I'm making. You're not going to learn from Hurricane Katrina. we're going to go back and make the exact same mistakes again. Only the next time we're going to build those houses stronger. Right now, out toward Pensacola, Florida, there's a barrier island out there. And they are now developing those barrier islands off the coast of Pensacola, Florida, with high-rise condominiums. I mean, these things are 20 stories tall. And they're really building them well. I mean, they're sinking concrete piers into the sand. Now, sometimes these barrier islands are just moved. They're just, and a hurricane comes in and just eradicates the island. I don't think anybody is thinking ahead 20, 30, 50 years from now when a hurricane comes in there and just removes the island. Now, here are these condominiums, 20 stories tall, and if we're successful, they'll still be there after the hurricane's gone and after the island is gone, a total loss. Now, those oil platforms out in the Gulf, those things are massive. I mean, they weigh 100,000 tons. They're bigger than two Queen Marys. They're bigger than two Titanics. And it's knocking those things over and sinking those. So those hurricanes are pretty powerful. Now, we want to live on that coast. And by God, we're going to live there, come hell or high water, come God, or hurricanes, or tornadoes, or storm surges, or tsunamis, we're going to live there. Now, the Bible tells you to flee the seacoast and flee to the mountains when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. I looked at that some years back, and I said, well, I guess it's time for me to leave the San Francisco Bay Area and to move to Idaho. So I left the seacoast and I went up in the mountains. That just kind of made sense to me. I did that back in 1970. 35 years later, we still have not had this disaster that has been predicted to come called the Great Tribulation. We're still waiting for it. The Apostle Paul was waiting for it. Generation after generation for the last 2,000 years has been waiting for it. And every day that goes by brings you one day closer to the event. But nobody knows when it's going to happen. So my common sense says to me, well, every generation then, based upon Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, was instructed by the Messiah to be prepared for that eventuality. And it's summed up in a parable called the Parable of the Ten Virgins. And these ten virgins are living their lives and doing their thing in life, whatever it happens to be. Five of these virgins have oil for their lamps and five of them don't. We don't know why the five that don't have the oil for their lamps have been remiss and why they haven't stored up the oil for their lamps, but for some reason they have. Now the bridegroom comes, and the five that have the oil, they're ready, they're prepared, and they go off to meet the bridegroom. And the five that don't have the oil come to the five that do have the oil, and they say, hey, share your oil with us. Hey, we want you to be a good communist. We want you to share and share alike. From each according to his ability and to each according to his need. You've got the oil and we don't. You've got the ability to provide us with oil and we don't. So the five selfish capitalist virgins who have the oil say to those communist virgins who don't have the oil, no, 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 we cannot give you of our oil. Because if we do, then we won't have enough for ourselves. Now this reminds me of triage. This triage, it's a French word, a French term. And they use it generally in war. And what happens is, you've got a bunch of people who have been injured. And so the doctor comes in and he says, well, we have finite resources. We just have a few medical resources here. And we want these resources to be allocated to do the most good. So how do we do that? Well, first of all, they take a look at the 100 people that are all injured. Now, all these people are bleeding. All of these people are feeling real bad. All of these people could use some medical attention. And they take a look and they say, well, this guy's got a sliver in his finger. And I'm sure it's painful and I'm sure it hurts a lot. And yes, this guy needs to have the splinter taken out. But if nobody does anything for this guy, he's not going to die. So they put him over in a group, and they call these are the people that don't need any medical attention at all. Zero medical attention, they're going to survive anyway. Yeah, they're going to be uncomfortable. Yeah, they're going to be miserable. Yeah, they're going to hurt real bad. But they're not going to die. They come to another guy over here, and he's got his brains laying on the ground. He's not dead yet. But they take a look at him and say, listen, there isn't anything that we can do for this guy that's going to save him. He's just, you know, minutes away from death. He's breathing his last breaths. He's going to die. Nothing we can do is going to save him. So they take all of those guys and they put those guys into the second group over here and they say, well, we don't need to spend any of our medical resources on that group of people because nothing that we're going to do is going to be of any benefit. And so every bandage, every vaccination, every shot that we give them is just wasted because they're going to die anyway. Then they come to the third group. These are people that are seriously injured and that will die if they're not treated. But there is, if they are treated, every reason to believe that they could survive. They've got an arm cut off and they're bleeding to death, so if we were to put a tourniquet on here, sew up this stub, this guy would probably survive. You know, he's gonna have one arm missing, but he's gonna live. But if we don't do anything, he's gonna bleed to death. So they take the medical supplies and they use it on that third group. And when they get all through out of the 100 people, they save 67. So they have used the scarce medical supplies to get the most bang for the buck. All right, now let's come back here to our story on inflation. We're not going to stop the war. We're not going to stop the Federal Reserve. We're not going to eliminate the need for the supplies that all of us need. But you can go out here and you can preach your heart out until you're blue in the face. And most people aren't going to listen to you. Most people aren't going to hear you. You don't need to spend any resources on those people at all. They can't save themselves. They will not save themselves. And they'll swamp your boat if you haul them on. So you might as well leave those guys out of the picture altogether. You divide people up into three groups. There are some people that will listen, and they like what you're saying, but they don't have the resources, they don't have the moxie, they don't have the ability, they don't have the street sense to put this together and to do anything intelligent or constructive that could save their lives. They're, in a word, dumb, blonde ditzes. So you got, on the one hand, you got the guys over here that they're not going to listen. They're the naysayers. They're the people that say, well, no, I don't believe you. And then you got the guys over here that are the dingbats. And they say, oh yeah, I hear you. And I'm going to do this. But they haven't got the street sense to put it all together. Then there's a small group of people over here that have some moxie. They've got some street sense. They don't have direction. They don't know what's going to happen. But when you come to these guys and you tell them, hey, listen, can you see this problem over here? Can you see the logic behind this? And can you take action? I've had people say to me, well, I know where I'm going to go. I'm going to go down by you, Mr. Gordon. And I keep telling them, you know, I'm an old man already, pushing 70. Do you think that you want to put your eggs in my basket, an old fart like me? You think that I can save you? You know, if I could save myself, I'd be doing a big trick. I don't think I'd depend on Georgie Gordon. I think I'd depend on myself. Now, let's go back here to this Hurricane Katrina. You know, if those people had been prepared, if you'd have known a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years in advance that New Orleans was going to get hit by this Category 4 storm, could you have prepared yourself for that storm? Well, the answer is absolutely. In fact, if you knew that you were on the Titanic and that the Titanic was going to hit an iceberg and was going to sink, would you buy a ticket? I think anybody that knew what was going to happen would pass and say, I think I'll take some other boat. Assuming that you didn't know the Titanic was going to sink, but you got on board, and as we're crossing the ocean, I come to you and I say, I had a dream last night. I had a vision. And the ship is going to hit an iceberg and it's going to sink in 2 hours and 20 minutes. You remember the Titanic, the unsinkable ship built by the lowest bidder, Harlan and Wolff? You always want to remember it's the low bidder that builds these things. They're not putting anything extra in this stuff. They don't have to. It's what the contract calls for. That's what we're going to put in. Now, you might be able to convince a few people that they should take action. If you knew what was going to happen, you could take action and prevent this from happening to you. You people up in Seattle, you know that mountain over there is going to blow up. You just don't know when. What do you think that's going to do to property values in Puyallup, Washington? You think those $300,000 houses are going to be in greater demand as that volcano is erupting, or in lesser demand? Do you think property values are going to escalate, or do you think they're going to deflate? So my common sense would say to me, now while the sun is shining and the bridegroom isn't here, and I'm living in the shadow of Mount Rainier, I'd say, you know, I think it's time for me to sell my property here in Puget Sound and to move to another location. So that instead of becoming a refugee, like the refugees from New Orleans, who I was watching on TV, and this lady was about to get on the bus, and this news guy rushes up and says, lady, do you know where you're going? And this lady says, no, I don't know where I'm going, and I don't really care. Wherever I'm going cannot be any worse than what I'm leaving. I would imagine that Jews getting on trains in 1938, 39, 40, 41 were probably saying the same thing. You see, they'd been segregated by the Germans into ghettos, and then it was so bad in the ghettos when they said, hey, listen, we got this relocation center over here at Auschwitz. God, you'll love it. Green lawns, putting greens. Just get on the train. Most of the people got on and went voluntarily. It wasn't until 90% of them had already gone that they were down to the last 10% that the Germans came along and stuck a gun in their face and said, okay, sucker, you're going to get on this train and go to Auschwitz, because if you don't, we're going to kill you. And the same thing I just observed down here in New Orleans. These people were willing to leave. They couldn't get out of there fast enough. Now try to go back. Do you remember down in New Orleans they said, this is a mandatory evacuation? And so 90% of the people, or 99%, evacuated. There were some ironclad holdouts, and they said, I'm not leaving. They've stayed to this day. They stayed. They didn't arrest them. They didn't throw them in jail. They didn't seize their property. And they're still there, protecting their property and living their lives and doing whatever they're doing there in New Orleans. So it teaches me a lesson. Same thing just happened over here in Orange, Texas. Son-in-law informs me the people voluntarily left. They cannot come back in. They can't come back to their homes. They're locked out. Those that wouldn't leave are locked in. They could leave if they want to, and the government wants them to leave, but they're not forcing them out. So that tells you a little part of the story. If the government came and forced you out, it would be a taking. That's a violation, remember, of the Fifth Amendment. It's a taking without just compensation. If you voluntarily leave, if you abandon your ship, anybody that comes along can take it by adverse possession. So learn a lesson from that. Maybe you don't want to leave. But if you're not going to leave, you better be prepared for what's going to happen. Now, living along the sea coasts, like Beaumont and Orange, Texas, and Port Arthur and Houston and so on, those are the lucrative places to live. I've been to Biloxi and Bay St. Louis and Gulfport. Nice places. Well, they used to be. Nice places. And the casinos, wonderful places to eat dinner, catch a show, little entertainment. Everybody loves the casinos. But when I went down there, I said to myself, you know, this is a fleeting experience. This is not going to last forever. Now, when we talk about inflation, you know, our illustrious chairman of the Federal Reserve tells us that we're suffering from exuberance, irrational exuberance. And he's telling us that the housing market is unsustainable, that the run-up in these housing prices is inflationary. Now, he doesn't use the same street language that we use down here on the block. He uses college language. He uses terms that are couched in 4 and 5 syllable words like irrational exuberance. What that means down here on the docks is you got your head up the wrong end of your anatomy. Your head's up the wrong end. And you better get straightened out here, son, because there's going to be some hard lessons to learn. Now, as I said when I started, most humans cannot learn from history. But George Washington had an observation here that he made in June of 1783. George Washington said in his circular letter of June 1783 to the governors of the several states, he wrote that, quote, honesty will be found on every experiment to be the best and only true policy. Being convinced that arguments deduced from this topic could with pertinency and force be made use of against any attempt to procure a paper currency. What George Washington said in that statement was, if you adopt paper money, you got your head up the wrong end of your anatomy. In June of 1783, Alexander Hamilton, in Resolutions for a New Constitution of the United States of America, set forth explicitly, he said, quote, to emit an unfunded paper as the sign of value ought not to continue a formal part of the Constitution, nor even hereafter to be employed. Being in its nature pregnant with abuses and liable to be made the engine of imposition and fraud, holding out temptation equally pernicious to the integrity of government and to the morals of the people. That was Alexander Hamilton. Now, these two of the founding fathers said paper money is bad news. These people had lived through the disastrous, ruinous hyperinflation of the Revolutionary War. They saw firsthand, like the people in Biloxi, what happens when a hurricane strikes the beach with this powerful storm surge. And they said, never again. Now, this is why I said human beings don't learn, because as soon as George Washington died, we established the United States National Bank, which was terminated by Andrew Jackson, reestablished by Abraham Lincoln, and expanded by Woodrow Wilson. Until today, we have exactly the same thing in the same position that we were in during the Revolutionary War. We're on the verge of hyperinflation again. Now, a lot of years have passed. I don't doubt that. You know, 200 years have gone by. But you'd think that with the experience of the colonists from 1690 to 1756, then the experience of the hyperinflation of the colonies during the Revolutionary War would have taught us, as it taught them, when they wrote into our Constitution 17 words designed to ban paper from our money system forever. You'd have thought Woodrow Wilson would have known better, wouldn't you? You'd have thought that your great-granddad back in 1900 would have said, never before and never again are we going to live through this. You'd think that the people of Biloxi would say, you know, I think maybe we better build our houses up back from the beach far enough that a 30-foot storm surge won't get it. They're not, they never in the past, and they are not in the future going to build in Biloxi to withstand that kind of a hurricane again. They're going to build just like they always have. And the people of Seattle and Portland are going to foot the bill. And they're going to build it, and it'll be destroyed again and again and again. And those people, when they rebuild New Orleans, Are they going to rebuild New Orleans in a way that will protect it from a Category 5 hurricane in the future? You can rest assured that that will not happen. Now, we knew it was going to happen. We could have taken steps to prevent it. In fact, $15 billion spent to protect New Orleans over the past, 15 years. It'd be $1 billion a year over the past 15 years would have saved $500 billion in reconstruction costs. We're going to spend the $500 billion, and we're not going to protect New Orleans from a new Category 5 storm. Just mark my words. I mean, you'll hear a lot of talk about it, but when the final bell is rung, nothing's going to change. And that's because human beings do not learn from history, and human beings do not learn from their mistakes. And if there's been some examples of it, send me an email, let me know, wouldn't you? Now, in 1783, now remember, in 1781, 2 years before 1783, the sailors in May now of 1781 are making suits out of this phony baloney money. The money has ceased to pass as currency. 2 years later, New Jersey issued 31,250 pounds. In 1786, New Jersey, an attempt was made to issue a larger amount. And William Patterson, subsequently a member of our Supreme Court, resisted the proposal with words as follows. Patterson, former Supreme Court Justice, said, quote, "An increase of paper money, especially if it be a tender, will destroy what little credit is left, will bewilder conscience in the maze of dishonest speculation, will allure some, and constrain others into the perpetuation of knavish acts, and will turn vice into a legal virtue, and sanctify iniquity by law. Men have, in the ordinary transactions of life, temptations enough to lead them from the path of rectitude. Why then pass laws for the purpose or give legislative sanction to positive acts of iniquity? Lead us not into temptation as a part of our Lord's Prayer, worthy of attention at all times, and especially at the present." Now, when the money goes bad and we go into hyperinflation and we finally repudiate the dollar, do you think that Americans will say, okay, we've learned our lesson, let's go back to gold and silver? I can assure you that that will be the farthest thing from the human mind. What we will do is go to government and say, save us, save us. And the government will say, we will vote for us, and we will create a new Federal Reserve that will give us new money. And we'll have new issues of paper money. Well, hell, you can see it right here in 1783, 2 years after the money had collapsed. Here's New Jersey, 24 months later, issuing new paper. I mean, come on, boys and girls, let's wake up. Smell the coffee. Nobody's going to learn from Biloxi or St. Louis. Nobody's going to learn from the collapse of the continental currency in 1781. We're going to go on with doing more of it. Now listen, that's because there are certain people, politicians at the top of the list, bankers, number two, and big business, that's insurance companies and multinational corporations. These guys make tons of money off of inflation. They make tons of money off of paper money. They make tons of profits. They live the sumptuous life off of stocks and bonds. Those yuppies making $1 million a year salaries living on Long Island and smoking Havana Cuban cigars are doing so at the expense of the little guys who are saving their money in their 401ks and in their Kroger plans that are being raped, robbed, and pillaged as they drive truck up and down the highways, and then invest their money in these stock portfolios and get ripped off every so many years by the people that deal in paper money. Paper money, boys and girls, is simply a license to steal. And that's why God prohibited it. That's why God forbade it. But the truck drivers don't learn from that. The little guys down here, they don't listen to God. They do not listen to Moses. They listen to Alan Greenspan and George Bush. Boys and girls, if we had a choice between listening to George Bush and Moses, George Bush will win every single time. If you have a choice between listening to Alan Greenspan, Walmart, or Price Waterhouse, and listening to Jesus of Nazareth, you will listen to Price Waterhouse and Wall Street every time. Every time. So make up your mind to it. So I'm not here to change American policy. That isn't going to happen. I'm here to protect myself from the consequences of these policies. I want to protect myself and my family from the consequences of the hyperinflation that's sure to come. In the same way that I protected myself from Hurricane Katrina. You didn't see me buying real estate in New Orleans. When I heard that that place was below sea level, I said, "My God, I can't believe that these people live here." And you're waiting for what? You're waiting for a big hurricane to hit Lake Pontchartrain, poke holes in your dikes, flood your city, and destroy the place? And you want to stay here? Okay. Well, take my share. You want to live next to Mount Rainier? You want to live here in Seattle, the home of Starbucks? The home of the nuclear fleet. What is it? They got a big island down there, a big Navy base down there in Puget Sound. Yeah, people want to live there in Puget Sound and Seattle and Tacoma because that's where the money's at. It's where the excitement's at. It's where the city is located. Right at the foot of Mount Rainier. Now, one of these days, that thing's going to go off, and when it does, there will be this weeping and wailing and this gnashing of teeth like you have now in New Orleans and along the Gulf Coast. You know, you'd think people would learn, but they don't, they won't, they haven't, they didn't, and they're not going to. So forget about beating your gums and trying to tell these people that they need to move, that they need to take action, they need to prepare. If you can save your own tail out of this, you'll be doing a big job. Don't worry about saving the other guy. Worry about saving yourself. Hang on, let me give you a reminder, and we'll be right back with more on inflation when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, and we're heard 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, history, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call The Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct. Get your pen and paper out here. Here's the number, 417-273-4967. Well, in spite of the fact that human beings do not learn well from their mistakes, some of us, if we pay attention, can learn from the mistakes of others. So during this period of Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita, as an illustration, we took a look at our own circumstance here, because if my house is destroyed, there will be no FEMA. There will be no Red Cross, Salvation Army. There will be no low-interest loans, no Social Security. I have to pay for that myself. So since I have to protect and I have to provide for myself, I said if my house burns down, if my house is destroyed for some reason, we'd have a hard time because most of our supplies are in the house. So I said, maybe I should have an outbuilding and put two or three jars of strawberry jam in that outbuilding along with two or three rolls of toilet paper. So that it's not very likely that my house is going to burn down and my outbuilding. It's more likely that one or the other will be destroyed. It's kind of like diversifying your portfolio. Do you want to have all of your money in Enron stock? Or should you have half of your money in Enron stock and half of your money in Pricewaterhouse or Bank of America or some other asset? So almost all financial advisors say you should have a little stock and a little bond and a little gold and silver and a little cash. You know, you should have it spread out so that if one goes haywire, something drastic happens, it doesn't wipe you out. Makes pretty good sense. Diversification makes a little more sense. I have a few sheep, I have a few cows, I have a few chickens, I have a few acres, I have a house or two, and I've got a little strawberry jam and a couple of rolls of toilet paper, and I keep it diversified so that in the event that an emergency, a disaster ensues, you know, I live here in Tornado Alley. I'm not concerned about the big earthquake, but I am concerned about tornadoes. That could happen, couldn't it? Especially when we look at time and chance. Now, I've talked about time and chance and the law and the benefits that you get from practicing the law. I won't rehash that. But just in case I break the law and I lose my benefits and I get my house blown down, I might have to recover from that. Now, do I want to be a refugee or do I want to be a master? So as we take a look at what happened down here on the Gulf Coast, and what's about to transpire in the future, we find that there's a contest between the citizenry and the government over who is going to be the master and who's going to be the servant. At this juncture of history, in the year 2005, there's no contest. The government is the master and the people are the servants. And you can see that when people get on buses and they say, I don't know where the government is taking me. I don't know where I'm going. But I trust the government and I'm going to get on. That's not a master. That's a ward. When people take welfare and food stamps, when they take government benefits, they're no longer the masters controlling the government. They are the wards being controlled by the government. And the choice that our forefathers had was, do we want a king or do we want a republic? Do we want a limited government or do we want an all-powerful government? We adopted the limited government concept. That is, the government is limited in its powers, the people are empowered, but the people have to take care of themselves and they have to take care of the government. Over time, the politicians convinced the people that the government should take care of them. Well, any government's big enough to take care of you is big enough to control and rule over you. So it's my contention that you made a mistake when you signed on to these government programs. When you decided to rely upon FEMA instead of the God of Heaven, I think that was a mistake. But it's your mistake and it's your side effects. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. Let's see how FEMA takes care of you. Meanwhile, back on the farm, I think I'll rely upon the God of Abraham, and let's see if he can protect me from those hurricanes, tornadoes, and from this coming hyperinflation. So one of the first things that I observed was Bible prophecy, which said, I am going to eat your lunch if you don't practice my law. So I take a look at America and Americans, and I can see that America and Americans do not obey God and keep His commandments. So God said, I'm going to go ballistic on you people, and I'm going to eat your lunch. There's going to be earthquakes in diverse places. There's going to be volcanic activity. There are going to be hurricanes and tornadoes, and there are going to be political upsets and wars until you be destroyed. So knowing in advance, kind of like the people knowing that Hurricane Katrina is on its way, you had a few days warning. We have a few years warning. We know what's coming. I do not expect Americans to make any meaningful changes. I reported to you not too long ago when a reporter asked this woman in New Orleans, do you think that this is going to interfere with Mardi Gras? And she said, horse feathers, there will be Mardi Gras. I pointed out to you that I think Mardi Gras is your problem. I think that Hurricane Katrina was retribution for that witchcraft called Mardi Gras. I think Mardi Gras needs to be abolished. I mean, if you want to rebuild New Orleans, I think you better think about changing your ways. Here again, people don't learn from their mistakes. They don't learn from history. It's not very likely that these people are going to learn from Hurricane Katrina. In fact, I haven't heard anybody ever ask in retrospect, how come God punished us with this hurricane? I covered that with you with the Katrina series. I said, no, either one of two things. Either one, we evolved from green slime and there is no God. Or there is a God and he was ineffectual, unable to stop Hurricane Katrina because he's a weak-kneed God, doesn't have very much power. Or number three, he's got all the power in the world and he used Hurricane Katrina to kick you in the hiney. Nobody wants to hear that. So the preachers, they come up with some kind of a cock and bull story and they tell you, well, it's all in God's hands. And we just cannot understand the mind of God. And it's beyond our understanding. They get kind of sick, sweet, and syrupy. Ever notice that? Well, you know, just looking at it like a truck driver, I looked at that and I said, uh-oh. If you've got a God like that, who needs enemies? And in any event, common sense tells me New Orleans isn't the place that you want to live. Now, let me tell you a little something about housing here. Housing, the high cost of housing. Have you ever thought that government is the cause of this bubble, this high cost of housing? Well, you know, house prices in many communities, especially in urban areas on the east and west coasts, have soared in recent decades. Across America, real housing prices, and indeed across many nations of Europe, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Great Britain, these prices have risen relatively modestly since 1950, that about 2% a year. Now, as for the more rapid rise in real prices, real estate prices, in the last several years, some people blame low mortgage interest rates resulting from the Federal Reserve's easy monetary policy, which made homes affordable to more and more Americans. 68% of Americans now claim to be homeowners. Now, the key underlying reason for rising house prices is supply, according to economist Edward Glazier. Since 1970, home builders have faced increasing difficulty in obtaining regulatory approval for the construction of new homes. Local residents, more educated, more affluent, have had a greater ability to block new housing projects should they be deemed harmful to their own interests, for example, to the value of their own existing homes. So as a result, cities have changed from urban growth machines to homeowners cooperatives. The authors write in Why Have House Prices Gone Up? It's working paper number 111-29. Now, looking at 316 metropolitan areas of the continental United States, the authors note that the average home price has increased 1.7% faster than general inflation annually. They've gone up from $59,000 in 1950, calculated in 2,000 inflated dollars. They've gone up from $59,000 to $138,000 in the year 2000. In other words, they've doubled. More notable is a growing variance in price. Average prices rose 72% since 1970. But the spread of prices, that is, the prices measured by the standard deviation across metropolitan areas, increased 247%. Did you get that? 247%, as contractors had difficulty finding suitable building lots in what are regarded as hot housing markets. Well, hang on here a second, boys and girls. Why do building contractors find it difficult to find building lots in San Francisco, Boston, and New York? There's no shortage of building lots here in Gainesville, Isabella, or Theodosia, Missouri. You ever wonder about that? What does government add to the price of a house by regulation and control? How much is added to the price of an automobile by OSHA, the EPA, or FEMA? You ever wonder about that? How much do all of these government regulations cost us as consumers when we go to buy the finished product? Well, hang on to your hats, boys and girls. The answer is 40%. Government regulation adds 40% to the price of your house. So if you just closed on a $400,000 house, you just went out and signed a contract and paid $400,000 for a house up in Chicago, New York, Boston, or San Francisco, well, listen, $160,000 of that price, 40%, is the direct cost for the permits, for the regulation, for the controls, for the building departments, for the electrical departments, and all of these regulations to make you safe and happy and comfy. Did you know that? Now, I live in a county without building permits, and so I'm not safe, I'm not happy, and I'm not comfy, and I'm not secure, and I'm not being protected. And I'm just as happy as a clam at high tide. And the reason for that is it saves me 40% on my construction costs. I don't have a building department, an electrical department. I don't have a plumbing department. I don't have OSHA, the EPA, or FEMA, or anybody else knocking on my door, demanding money and fees, or regulations that say you can't build here, but you can build over there. Now, that's the answer. So if you want to know, in the housing market, what has caused 40% of the inflation in these markets, especially the hot markets like Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, Boston, New York, Chicago, it's regulations and controls. Do you know why your economy is stagnant and why the Chinese economy is growing 7% a year? It's regulation and control. Everywhere that government sticks in its nose, you have less efficiency, higher costs, more inflation. Now, the Chinese, who had this highly regulated communist economy, threw that away and adopted the free market in China. And it has just been exploding with growth over the last 10 or 15 years. If you want the American economy to grow, abolish OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, the IRS, and leave Americans alone and let us go to work. stop giving us welfare and food stamps and feeding us at the government trough. Just let Americans alone and let them go to work. Let them keep everything that they can produce. And you will see an America that will explode with productivity, just like it exploded with productivity and growth between 1800 and 1950. Now, if you want this economy to stagnate, to self-destruct, to implode, put on more restrictions. My God, boys and girls, if a little bit of OSHA is good, wouldn't twice as much OSHA be even better? Look, if your building department and the regulations that are imposed upon builders and homeowners is good, wouldn't twice as much red tape, twice as much building department, twice as much security, twice as much fees for building permits be even better? All you got to do is ask yourself, if this is good, twice as much should be twice as good. Now you just take a look around you and see, well, what works and what doesn't work. Now our economy is still functioning in spite of OSHA, the EPA, and all the government regulations. But it isn't growing anywhere near the way it used to. And exporting jobs overseas, you know, that doesn't benefit those of us down here at the lower echelons. It probably makes a lot of money for multinational corporations and yuppies selling stock on the stock market. It makes lots of money for politicians and bankers and stockbrokers. I can imagine lots of people making lots of money by exporting jobs to India, but how in the hell does that benefit you and me? And do Americans then remember that and go to the polls? No. Americans, I don't know about the rest of you people in the world, but I can tell you from personal experience, Americans cannot remember from one election to the next. Now, you just elected George Bush, and his popularity has sunk now to about 35 or 40%. Obviously, people aren't too happy with George Bush, the president. They were a whole lot happier with George Bush, the candidate, than they are now with George Bush, the president. Do you think people will remember that in 2006? Do you think people will be able to put $3 a gallon gasoline together with the Republican Party in 2006? I'm here to tell you that they won't. Because between now and 2006, George Bush is going to make a deal with the Saudis or somebody, and they're going to lower the price of oil from $60 to $30 or $40, and George Bush will be looked upon as the savior of America. See, what they do is this. They take gas prices at $1.50. They run them up to $3. Everybody gets mad as hell. They lower those prices back to $2 or $2.25. And everybody thinks that the guy that was the scoundrel last month is the hero this month. Now, paper money is our problem. Paper money and the expansion of credit through the Federal Reserve is the cause of the inflation. When this thing turns turtle, will people repudiate the Federal Reserve, repudiate paper money? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The politicians will come from the other party and say, give us your vote and we will fix the problem with a new Federal Reserve and a new color money. And we'll go right back to paper money again. Mark my words. We'll go right back to the same mistakes. Human beings, unlike a dog, cannot learn from their mistakes. We didn't learn from Hurricane Camille, and we will not learn from Hurricane Katrina. You haven't learned from World War II, Vietnam. You haven't learned from Iraq or Afghanistan. You will continue to vote these people back into office who will reward you with more wars and more costs, more inflation, more of the same. Welcome to democracy. Construction costs do not explain the price surge or the greatest variance. And the authors note that since 1970, the after-inflation cost of building a house has declined slightly on a nationwide basis. Even in booming markets, construction cost increases have been modest. Real construction costs between 1970 and 2000 rose a mere 4.5% in the San Francisco Bay Area, 6.6% in Boston. In those same three decades, house prices rose 270% in San Francisco and 127% in Boston. It's not the cost of plywood and 2x4s, boys and girls. It's the cost of permits and environmental impact statements. That's what runs the cost of building up. Moreover, improvement in the quality of houses accounts for only about 1/4 of the average increase in average housing values. What has happened is that fewer homes are being built relative to the existing stock of houses. In the sample of 120 metropolitan areas, the housing stock climbed 40% in the 1950s. In the 1990s, housing stock rose only 14%. The 1990s average change for the 120 areas was double that in the booming markets of San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, where it is more difficult getting land approved for development. It's zoning and planning, the building department, environmental impact statements. As evidence of this difficulty, the authors note that the physical cost of building a home as a percentage of the home price has actually diminished over time. The cost of buying 2x4s and plywood relative to the price increases in inflation has gone down. It's deflated. In 1970 and earlier, structure costs, the cost of the plywood and the 2x4s, represented 90% of the value of a home in most areas. But since 1980, the cost of land and obtaining regulatory approval has now shrunk the importance of building costs as a factor in house prices. For instance, along a swath of the East Coast, roughly approximated by Amtrak's Northeast Corridor, the non-structure component of house value exceeded 40% by 1990. More than 40% of the price of your house is in red tape. Now, you people down in Biloxi, down along the Gulf Coast with FEMA, have you noticed some red tape? Government forms to fill out? By 2000, this pattern had spread to 27 metropolitan areas. In the San Francisco Bay Area, an outlier among metropolitan areas, whatever outlier means, structure costs probably represent no more than 30% of house value. Boys and girls, when you buy a house in San Francisco, and the median price now is $500,000, The nuts and bolts, the boards and the plywood are $150,000 and the other $350,000, is regulatory control. It's the government bureaucracy. Now that's inflation. It's inflation caused by government regulation. Thought that would make your day. All right, we're about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about this thing called inflation. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. Hey, we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.